Tina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face Off here on WGN. Tina Martini, Rich Linkoff. We are without Sam Panianovich, our moderator today, so we're going to have to wing it as both host and moderator today. Tina, are we ready for this?
Yeah, I'm totally ready for it. We're winging it, man.
Let's try not to screw up too many names. We've got a jam-packed show today, as always. Man, there is a lot going on in the legal world, Tina. We've got Inside Out columnist Sussler and Martini, of course. We've got Antonio Romanucci joining us about the Vegas shooting lawsuits. We've got some NIU College of Law folks talking about a prisoner's rights project, Anthony Krause from McCorkle litigation. But first and foremost, breaking news, the Paul Manafort jury is out. We've got Patrick Collins on the phone. Patrick, thank you for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Good to be here, Rich and Tina. Thanks.
Patrick, you spent 12 years as an assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago, the last four of which were as a supervisor in the corruption unit. We've all been following the Manafort trial closely. The jury went out today. A couple quick questions. I know generally a rule of thumb is that, what, for every 2 days that a jury takes place, the jury is thought to be out 1 day. What do you think of the fact that when the defense rested, they didn't call any witnesses? Manafort didn't testify. Were you surprised by that, given the years that you spent prosecuting these cases? What does that tell us about the way Manafort and his legal team are looking at the evidence presented against them and their defense?
Well, as to the issue of surprise, Rich, I mean, the reality is after 12 years of trying cases and then in the government and 10 in private practice, the reality is in most federal criminal trials, there's very little defense. And I think the reason for that, is that it allows a defense attorney to really take off on the government's case when they're doing their closing argument. I mean, the reality is if you put on a little bit of case, both, A, the government can comment on the case that the defense puts on, but then the defendant is sort of hemmed in a bit. But I think by putting on no case, first of all, you basically tell the jury that, you know, they didn't prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. You take off after this guy, Rich Gates, who's the star witness for the government. And then as they did in their closing, they also sort of took off on the sort of the whole special prosecutor theme to make it seem like this was a desperate move and this Manafort guy was caught in something much bigger than him, really trying to appeal, I think, to any real Trump voter in that jury box. So I think the reality is, and what was frustrating as a prosecutor, because you'd hear defense lawyers get up and in their opening statement talk about, you know, you're going to hear from my client and tell the biographical story, and then you'd never hear from the client at the end of the case. But this is pretty much how most cases go, not all, but most, where defense lawyers just will ultimately choose to attack the government's case rather than put on their own case.
So what do you think is happening in that room right now as the jury is deliberating? Just looking back on the trial, what do you think are the points that are weighing most heavily on the jurors' minds as they're deliberating?
Well, Tina, obviously that's the million-dollar question, and you never know exactly what's going on back there. I mean, first of all, you have a case, let's face it, it's tax fraud and bank fraud, not very sexy stuff. You had 18 counts. There's 388 documents, I think, went back. There are 27 witnesses that went through the trial room. You know, I think at the end of the day, this is going to be a referendum on Rich Gates. Again, he's the two-decade-long close associate of Manafort who's pled guilty to the very crimes that Manafort was charged with. And I suspect at some point in time, Tina, after they pick the foreperson and start to go through the evidence, every juror does it differently, there's going to be a very animated discussion about Rich Gates and whether he's credible, whether the documents corroborate him. I mean, that's if they're doing their job right, that I think ultimately is what it mostly will be about. I think if they're human, which they are, you're also, Tina, going to have a situation where some of them are going to talk about the special prosecutor thing. And, you know, this is this all about flipping him on Trump? And is this guy You know, should this guy really even be here? I mean, I think you might hear some of that stuff, which is really not what they are supposed to be talking about. But that's the kind of stuff, if I was a prosecutor, I would be concerned that they will talk about.
How about the judge? Because we heard a lot from this case about the judge. And, you know, he had he was very vocal, I think, in going after the government's case. He admonished them for rolling their eyes, and he told them don't mention collusion. And early on, he said, stop talking about the lavish lifestyle, the ostrich jacket, and all of the things that Manafort was spending his money on. Does that resonate with a jury? I mean, on the one hand, you would imagine the jury would say, you know, if the judge is so hard on one side, he must be signaling to us that there's a problem with the evidence. And how do you, as a prosecutor, if so, counter that kind of interaction from the judge?
Well, first, if I was a prosecutor, I'd be scared to death of that very issue, that the judge throughout the trial, more so at the beginning, and I think he slowed down towards the end, but he was really hard on the prosecution, told them to move along, suggesting to the jury that some of what the government was doing was a waste of time. And as a prosecutor, I'd be very concerned that, just as you said, Rich, that the judge is, according to the jury, again, keep in mind, most of these jurors have never been in the courtroom before, that the judge, you know, who's the guy who gives them lunch and who tells a good joke every once in a while, is someone that they identify with. And if this judge thinks this is a waste of time, and then they probably should too. I think the way they countered it, Rich, and they tried very hard in the jury instruction conference to get some instructions, really two instructions I think were really critical. One is that the judge effectively told the jury in one of the instructions that the jury should not consider any opinions that he allegedly expressed during the course of the trial. So I think that's something, at least if someone's trying to defend this issue when it comes up in the jury room, they can point to that. And the second one really relates to this motive issue I was talking about the special prosecutor case and whether Manafort deserved to be in this courtroom, because it's really about trying to get Trump. He basically gave the government an instruction that the jury is not to consider the motive of the prosecutors in bringing this case. And so, you know, as trial lawyers, sometimes we overinflate the value of these instructions, but those are two instructions that will help counter, I think, those issues that came up at the trial.
Well, it's a fascinating case to cover. Patrick Collins is a fellow in the American College of Trial Lawyers, former federal prosecutor, and a partner in the Special Matters and Investigations Group for King & Spalding. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us, and please come back on our show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He's been selected to the 2017 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2017. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEEK Incorporated, and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Rich also is the legal analyst for The Bill and Wendy Show and Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez on WGN. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Next on Legal Face-Off, we have Antonio Romanucci, principal and partner at Romanucci & Blandin, who is representing some of the victims of the Las Vegas shooting. Antonio, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
So, Antonio, it's been almost a year now since Stephen Paddock shot 58 concertgoers from the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas and injured hundreds of others. MGM owns Mandalay Bay and has filed a lawsuit in federal court arguing that the victims' lawsuits, many of which were filed by you, must be dismissed under a 2002 law that extends liability protection to companies that use an anti-terrorism technology. What is your position on these lawsuits?
Well, first of all, not only is the lawsuit premature, but this is an unprecedented act by a defendant in a case of such a magnitude to file this sort of lawsuit, which is called a declaratory action, this early on. Clearly, I think MGM feels the heat and its exposure to this case, and so they are taking extraordinary measures to try and get a dismissal of this case early on by getting a judge to agree that it has no liability.
Explain to us, if you can, to our listeners, what the theory, let's talk about your theory of recovery against MGM and what their declaratory judgment theory is.
Well, you know, our theory against MGM is actually quite simple. They not only enabled, but fostered and helped Stephen Paddock carry up all the weapons that he needed in order to carry out this extraordinary act of violence against so many innocent people. You know, we have, and many people have seen, the videotaped surveillance of MGM employees assisting Stephen Paddock up the service elevators and carrying these bags containing long guns up to his room. But the theory extends just beyond the day that MGM helped Stephen Paddock up the elevator. It also extends to years before that, when MGM knew that there were other people that wanted to do the same thing. And that's known as the Dunlop case. This individual, 2 years prior to the Stephen Paddock incident, also carried up long guns up to his room in his failed attempt to punch out the windows and shoot at innocent people on the street. So MGM was fully aware that this was a foreseeable act long before Stephen Paddock, and they did not take appropriate security measures to prevent this sort of incident from happening.
So what do you think hotels like Mandalay Bay can do and should do differently going forward to prevent these types of tragedies? What kinds of security measures do you think they could implement differently than what they did in this instance?
Well, without getting into extraordinary detail, the Las Vegas hotels were mandated to update their security measures every year. I don't recall the exact date the last time Mandalay Bay had updated their security protocol, but it had been at least 10 years where Mandalay Bay had not updated its security protocols. On the other hand, as far as we know right now, despite the troubles that the Wynn hotels are having with respect to the namesake, the Wynn hotels were leading the gold standard in security measures on the Las Vegas Strip. So they had implemented many, many measures that Mandalay Bay failed to implement, which would have absolutely prevented this shooting. So had Mandalay Bay updated its security measures as other hotels had done and followed the gold standard, followed what the standards are as our nation progresses in this era of violence, this shooting was certainly foreseeable and preventable.
Isn't it, I mean, MGM would say, and I will imagine will say, that you can't predict the extraordinary, you know, acts of a deranged shooter just because someone is bringing up, you know, large bags in a hotel room in an elevator doesn't mean that they're going to knock out a window and shoot up a crowd of concert goers. How do you respond to that?
Well, you raise a good point, and that's only one part of the equation. If Mandalay Bay fails to inspect the bags, then they need to explain why for 4 days they allowed Stephen Paddock to stay in his room without either a well-being check or without housekeeping or any type of service at all. When it was determined that he had bolted the emergency exit shut with what are those called, like an L-shaped, I forgot what the name is right now, so you'll have to excuse me. You can tell I'm not that handy. But when he bolted the doors shut and the security guards were made aware of it, what caused their delay in calling the Las Vegas police? So that's only one piece of the puzzle, and it's fair to ask that question, but you have to look at the totality of what happened. And when you look at the totality, there were failures on many, many different levels here, which created the circumstances for this event to happen.
So where do the cases currently stand? Where are we right now with this all?
So right now, because of MGM's attempt at forum shopping these cases, because now we know that they have openly admitted that their goal is to remove these cases to federal court because they feel that they can get a better venue out of federal court than state court, we're in the process of determining where we're going to land. We probably won't know that now. It's mid-August. We probably won't know until at least the end of September whether or not these cases will remain in state court or, I'm sorry, right now they're remanded or removed to federal court or whether we get remanded back to state court. So we've got a little bit of time before we know where we'll be litigating these cases. So we're not at issue yet.
That's Antonio Romanucci, principal and partner with Romanucci and Blandin at rblaw.net. Thanks so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio.
Thank you. Very nice talking to all of you.
Next up on Legal Face-Off is Northern Illinois University College of Law Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Professor of Law, Dean Mark Falkoff, to talk about the Prisoners' Rights Project. Professor, welcome to Legal Face-Off, and you've got a full house there as well.
We do. We do. Thank you very much. We have the lawyer instructor who's leading the project, and we have several of the students.
Terrific. So why don't we kick things off by hearing from you what the Prisoners' Rights Project is?
Well, this is an opportunity that was presented to us by the Federal Bar Association in the Western District and by the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. And the basic idea is that there are any number of prisoners who are filing civil rights lawsuits claiming in one way or another that their constitutional rights have been violated because of the conditions in the prison or sometimes because of their medical treatment. And these folks typically, almost always, don't have counsel representing them. And the judges and the Bar Association basically thought to themselves, well, one possible place to get some representation and to enhance the training of law students would be to look at law schools and see if any law schools would be interested in putting together a project whereby the students would take on several of these cases. So they brought that idea to Northern Illinois, and we very much liked the idea, and we put together this project.
So to that point, Ruben Castillo, the Honorable Ruben Castillo, who is the Chief Judge for the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, called this program a win for the court, a win for prisoners, a win for the College of Law, the NIU College of Law, and a win for the Sixth Amendment. I'd like to hear from your students how they think that they will benefit from being involved in this program.
Well, I personally...
Remind us of your name again before you speak, if you can.
Oh, no problem. Alante Holiday, 3L student. For me, I'm just getting real-life practical experience. It's nice, you know, when we're in the classroom and we get to learn about, you know, the theory of the law, but I think nothing can replace actual hands-on experience. So being able to have real-life client interaction, being able to present, you know, status hearings in front of a judge and, you know, pushing forward a case, I feel like is indispensable. So I feel like one of the things that I look forward to is actually getting that real-life hands-on experience that will help me for after graduation.
And if I may, Stephanie, what do you think about the prospect of handling a case all the way through trial?
I'm very excited for the opportunity, especially to have such quality supervision here and to know that what we're doing, the work that we're doing, is for such a great purpose.
Robert, what do you think?
My name is Robert Buanda, and I'm very excited to be working on a hands-on project. Like Alonce and Stephanie both said, I echo their sentiments that it's a very good opportunity, and we're under very good leadership. So,
are you all in your third year of law school?
Yeah.
Correct.
Yep.
So we're restricting the program to third-year students, at least at the outset, and we're keeping the program relatively small at this point. There are just six students who've applied and been accepted into the program. Well, this is our pilot year, and we'll see how things go. I personally would love to see this expanded because this is very much in keeping with the focus in the law school on experiential learning and just broadening the skills curriculum.
Well, I'll echo that. You know, our listeners know that I'm a proud alum of the College of Law, NIU College of Law. I'm on the Board of Visitors with Dean Falkoff, and one of the most rewarding parts of my experience at Northern, way back when, you know, going back just a couple of years, was my experience as a 3L. I happened to work for the state's attorney in DeKalb County, and by the time I got out of law school, I had about 100 cases under my belt that I personally tried. But my question to you, students, is it daunting knowing that you're going to be handling really important cases and having people's lives in your hands and, you know, you don't have a ton of experience doing that? Is that something that's going to intimidate you?
This is Stephanie Moore. I think that it's important to take the job very serious. You know, I'm going to walk into this with my head on straight, knowing the seriousness of what I'm doing. But again, I have faith in my leadership. I have faith in the supervisor. So I am not fearful of the task at hand. I'm more excited, if anything else.
Hi, this is Robert Buanda. And I guess I am a bit intimidated about
don't tell anyone. You're on WGN. Don't say that. Just kidding. Good, honest answer, though.
Every surgeon has to operate for the first time.
Once. That's right.
But yeah, I'm confident that with the supervision that we have, and I'll be working with a partner, and I have all of the professors here at NIU who are helpful, always very helpful, so I'm confident that it'll be a good experience. I'm very excited for it.
This is Alante Holiday again. I would be lying to you if I didn't say there weren't any nerves. Of course, there's some nerves, but I feel like all of our nerves are relieved by, you know, having someone who's going to help us all the way through the case, you know, who's going to be by us for when we do have questions. And I feel like with preparation and, you know, making sure that we put in the time, the effort, and making sure we do exactly what we need to do on our end, I feel like all those nerves will eventually go away. But, yeah, I am a little nervous.
And if I may say, Rich, it's Mark again, the lawyer who's leading this project, Lisa Jensen, is a highly accomplished, very skilled lawyer. So you've heard all the students express confidence in the leadership, and they're expressing confidence in her. She's a veteran of these kinds of cases.
Well, Lisa, we actually have a question for you. We've extensively covered on Legal Face-Off over the past few years numerous examples of people who have been wrongly convicted and in many cases spending decades in jail for crimes that they didn't commit. Many of these cases involve minorities and people without much in the way of economic resources and who are frequently victims of ineffective counsel. Besides your program, what can be done to avoid putting innocent people behind bars?
Well, the program that we're handling here at NIU has to do mainly with civil cases. Once they have been convicted, it doesn't focus on the legality of the conviction, but rather on the type of situation that they are faced once they're in prison. So it has to do with excessive force by guards, not getting medical care, and so forth. But I think the same answer to why we're able to provide good representation for those types of problems is the same answer to your question, which is representation, good, fair representation of these types of clients, even if they don't have the means or wherewithal to pay for it, is what's so vitally important to make sure that they get the representation they need.
And it's Mark again. So my academic area of expertise is habeas corpus law, which jives very nicely with the question that you just asked. And, of course, the chief problem with these wrongful convictions, well, there are any number of reasons for that, but one of the chief problems is the lack of competent counsel, which in many cases is tied directly to the inability of counsel to be paid meaningfully, the inability of, apparently of the legal community to be able to hire high-quality students out of law school and pay them a living wage. So just trying to tie it all back in, one of the benefits of a school like NIU is that our tuition, comparatively speaking, is quite low when you think about it in relation to other law schools. And we give our students the kind of hands-on education that allows them to emerge as qualified lawyers, but also able to take positions as prosecutors and defense counsel who are going to act both ethically and competently. So that's not a direct answer to your question, but I think that this project is perfectly in keeping with that kind of vision for what a public law school in the public service is all about.
Northern Illinois University College of Law Associate Dean Mark Falkoff, Lisa Jensen from Jensen Law Office, LLC.com, and especially thank you to Alante Holiday, Robert Belanda, Stephanie Moore, all 3L law students at NAU College of Law, doing very important work for the Prisoners' Rights Project. Thank you so much for your work on this project and also your continued dedication to the school and to the practice of law. The website for NIU is niu.edu/law. Thanks so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, Tina, I'm very excited for this next guest on an incredibly busy Legal Face-Off here on a Thursday in Chicago. Not just because I've known my guest, Anthony, our guest, for a long time and use his company a lot, but because he is our, drumroll please,
LFO sponsor.
First sponsor. Tony, welcome. Anthony Krause is vice president from McCorkle Litigation Services. I'll let Anthony introduce your colleague as well.
Yes, my colleague is Dawn DeJadas, and she has been our office manager for just about a year right now, and we love her.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. My first question is, tell us how long your company has been around and what you do.
My stepfather, Charlie McCorkle, started in 1948, so we've been around, you know, just about 70 years, and we support the legal field in any way that we can, mostly depositions, trial proceedings, and trial presentation as well.
So what, tell us a little bit about stories you've got, anything, any anecdotes you care to share, because obviously your services are rendered in a very high stress situation. Do you have any stories that you care to share that you've had over the years of court reporters, for example, and trial or in depositions that, have had interesting things happen?
Okay, I will just make a quick reference.
Keep it clean now,
yes,
Tony.
Keep it clean, yes.
Come on, we're a family show.
I came with
standards
several,
and practices are listening.
Came with several pages.
We will tell our audience that we vetted some beforehand that involves some missing body parts and things, but go ahead. What do you got?
All right, I'll pass it to Dawn then.
Uh-oh.
Okay, we've had a trial that was going on for very high profile trial, excuse me, and the court reporter went into labor. Mm. And the two opposing counsels were very upset that the reporter had gone into labor, and we had to send over another reporter to step in, and they continued just as if it was any other day with the trial, and she proceeded to get in a cab and go to Northwestern.
Ah.
Was it a boy or a girl?
It was a baby boy.
Nice.
Little baby McCorkle. I'm always amazed when I take depositions how calm the court reporters are in the face of, you know, really hostile depositions frequently or trials. You know, I'm sure it'll come as a surprise to a lot of our listeners, but lawyers can get very heated. They can get very passionate, and they fight frequently. In many depositions that I've been at, we've had to, you know, get to the point where we've had to call a judge and get the judge, you know, the judge to weigh in. How do you train your court reporters to be even keeled throughout the process and just, you know, stick to the facts while you've got, you know, sometimes lunatics, frankly, yelling in a conference room or at trial?
And you're one of them, Rich.
I am, yes, chief among them.
It's not even necessarily a training thing. It's more of an experience thing. A lot of our reporters, all of our reporters, go out with a big sister for a couple weeks before they go out on their own. The big sister will teach them how to maintain their calmness. And I've heard many stories of attorneys not just being calling judges, but actually getting into fisticuffs where they had to call the police.
Wow.
It's fairly amazing when you think about, you know, how long court reporting has been around and how much technology has evolved. Yet it's still one of those areas where someone typing into a machine manually is still in existence. I know a lot of courts have gone to, you know, electronic taping of the proceedings. Cook County hasn't yet. How do you feel about, you know, how your services remain relevant in, you know, the technological world that we are in now?
Okay, since I've started in McCorkle for 30 years, we've heard about the voice recognition coming and taking over. There's still going to have to be...
The robots of the future are coming.
But they're not, they don't understand accents. A lot of the expert doctors and citizens of America are not all the same speaking as we are. They all have a little bit of an accent. So hopefully we will be able to stay in business for a long time with that in mind. It's hard to get the people in high school to think of it because they feel that the voice recognition or AI will be coming into our arena and they will not be, they'll be out of a career. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Or fortunately, that's not the case for us. We plan on being around here for a long time.
Well, in that vein, you've got a great business. And what do you see for the future for your business? And what do you think you do differently that has made you so successful so far?
I believe it's our service. We have a family business. We take care of our clients, and we put out a quality transcript. We have proofreaders, and we have the best court reporters in the city of Chicago. They have been with us for many years.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned at the top of the piece, you know, McCorkle has been my go-to company for years. Tony and I have known each other for years. Great company, really reliable. I mean, what you want as an attorney, obviously, and Tina will attest to this, from a court reporter is, first of all, show up, right? I mean, you hear... You often hear that the secret to life is showing up. I think, you know, Keanu Reeves said it best in the movie Hardball. But it's true. I mean, first and foremost, you know, you can't proceed without a court reporter. So you guys are always very reliable. Then I think what you need, secondly, is accuracy. It's very important. I mean, all kidding aside, the services that you provide are incredibly important. We couldn't litigate these cases without a record of it. And the ability to go back and see what happened accurately is incredibly important. I think those two qualities are what you want from a transcription service. And you guys, you know, have always been really tops in that area. How do you, you know, make sure that everyone's meeting that standard?
Okay, well, we pick up the slack for a lot of other agencies. As in today, I was going to be over here 15 minutes ago with two other court reporters. And two of our clients called us because the court reporter didn't show up. So
wow.
Coming back to Tina's, you know, comment, we covered their butts and sent over the last two reporters we had. So I think it's just the great service that we provide is what keeps us going.
Anthony Krause, Vice President, and Don Dejadis. I'm so sorry. From McCorkle Litigation Services. You can reach them at McCorkleLitigation.com. Thanks so much for coming on the show, sharing some of your stories, and a huge thanks for being our first sponsor of Legal Face Off on WGN.
We appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much, Rich. Tina.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you, Tina.
Next up is one of our favorite segments on Legal Face Off. Our Inside Out columnists from Chicago Lawyer Magazine. One of them happens to be sitting a few inches from me. Her name is Christina Martini. And her co-author, what do you call yourself, columnist?
Co-columnist,
yes. Which is hard to say, is David Sussler. David is, of course, Associate General Counsel with National Material LP. He is a frequent guest on our show. David, Christina, also known as Sistini, welcome to Legal Face Off.
Thank you.
So the latest edition of Inside Out, which conceptually is the perspectives of an inside lawyer like David and an outside lawyer, Christina Martini, is different perspectives on one issue. The issue in the July 2018 edition, which can be found in Chicago Lawyer Magazine, is risky business, helping clients assess risk. David, as an outside counsel, someone who both deals with risk and who hires attorneys to deal with risk, what are the factors that you look for when assessing whether a deal or a trial? How do you deal with the risk associated with those kind of projects?
Well, it begins with asking a lot of questions that include that help you understand where this matter fits within your company. You know, it comes up most frequently, say, in a contract situation. So is the other side, is the customer a key customer? You know, are they a strategically important customer or sort of a one-off customer? What's the part that they're going to make out of our steel? You know, is it a safety-sensitive part or just something on the surface? So you can find out, well, what's the potential risk? That the risk being, like, if something goes wrong, are people going to get hurt, for example? That's sort of where I start. And then you look at the monetary risk. Well, what is our risk of losing money if something goes bad?
Tina, what makes assessing risk so difficult for lawyers?
Well, as outside counsel, we're obviously just a step removed from being entrenched in the business. So you need to know your client really well, and you need to know, obviously, taking a step back, you've got to know what the legal issues are. You need to be able to get to the right finish line in terms of assessing what the legal risk is. But then it's also knowing your client, knowing who the players are at the client, who are the key decision makers, and what their tolerance is for risk. And there are certain times when they're willing to take more risk than others. And one thing that I think is really important for outside counsel to be mindful of, in addition to the risks that David just mentioned, is the potential risk to reputation. Because oftentimes that ends up being backburnered as part of the analysis, but depending on the issue and the circumstances, the company's reputation and the client's reputation may be at risk, and you need to be mindful of that when you are counseling your client.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And to your, you know, good point, I think it's often undervalued as a factor when making these decisions, because in the short term, you're worried about, you know, the chances of success and the cost associated with litigation. You have to really think of the impact on your brand. David, I know that's important to you. You've got a trial coming up. We're lucky to have you because you're going to be, you know, busy with this trial and, in fact, are in the middle of trial prep as we speak. When specifically preparing for a trial, you're doing a risk analysis all the time, right? And you're considering how much risk you are going to, you know, absorb versus the potential outcome. With jury trials, obviously, you know, there's a lot of risk involved because that's a wild card. You don't know. You can do all the jury, you know, analysis in the world and you know, mock trials, but at the end of the day, you don't know what the 12 people in the box are going to do. That's very risky. So talk to us about, specifically as you're preparing for trial, how all of these factors come into play.
Well, it's kind of everything we've talked about so far get condensed and magnified, I think. You're always looking at, you know, well, what's the potential monetary gain, monetary loss, reputational gain? Again, you know, if you have litigation against a customer, what does this mean to the future of the customer? Are you still doing business with them? Are you not? And at this point, when you're preparing for trial and you're really into the minutiae, you're starting to look at, well, how is this going to play to a jury? And so you're thinking, should we go ahead or should we try to settle? That, I think, is usually on every lawyer's mind as they're preparing for trial. And it affects your strategy. It affects the way you prepare witness testimonies, witness order. All of those things come into play.
Tina Martini, your thoughts
on
that subject and, you know, how you are evaluating risk as you deal with maybe not a trial, mm-hmm. but a big case, a big deal, a big, you know, decision with a client. How's that all playing into it?
You mean how do I help them assess the risk?
Absolutely. You took the words directly out of my mouth and from the piece of paper in front of me.
Well, I think it's important to know how experienced your client is with any particular type of issue, whether it's a trial, whether it's working on a deal, whether it's launching a new product. You have to sort of know how experienced your client is. Have they been to the rodeo before, so to speak? And then you have to help your client issue spot. And so, again, sometimes some people are really good at navigating the politics. Sometimes some people are really good at navigating the substantive legal issues. But they need to guide you as outside counsel in terms of helping you navigate the political landscape as well as the risk landscape. And so it's asking the right questions of the client. And sometimes it's a very easy process because the client's done it before. and they have experience with it, and they also know the players. But in my experience, you can have a very sophisticated in-house counsel who's a really, really good lawyer and very savvy at navigating issues. And depending on the nature of the issue, sometimes it evolves over time, especially a matter that lasts for many months into years. Sometimes the key players change. Sometimes the risk tolerance changes. Sometimes the ownership of the client changes. And all these things have to be kept front and center during the conversation as the matter evolves over time.
Last question on Legal Face-Off. Who's the risk taker in the non-legal world between Sestini? Who pushes the envelope? You know, who's the daredevil? I kind of think Martini is more of a risk taker in everyday life. Am I right on that?
I think so, but we should hear what David has to say.
Well, you know, lawyers being naturally risk averse people. But as between,
I see a lot of pausing here. He's doing a cost benefit analysis as we speak.
Probably Martini pushed me.
Yes. Good answer. Well, certainly, as we've noted before, Sussler is a risk taker when it comes to the choice of jacket in the Chicago Lawyer picture. Very, very bold, very plaid. I like it, as you know. That is David Sussler. He is half of Inside Out. The better half is sitting next to me, Christina Martini. They are both columnists for years on Inside Out. How many years are we talking about here on Inside
Out? It's been since April of 2010, so we're going on 8.5 years.
Very, very impressive. In Chicago Lawyer Magazine, the website again is
ChicagoLawyerMagazine.com.
Check them out, July 2018, Risky Business. David, thank you for joining us. Good luck in your trial. Tina,
thank you.
See you in about 30 seconds.
Yes, thanks, Rich. Thanks, David.
We all know the legal world is complex and high-pressured. There's no room for error. That's why judges and attorneys across Chicagoland have trusted the expert court reporters at McCorkle Litigation Services since 1948. McCorkle Litigation Services has accurately recorded every word from thousands of legal proceedings. McCorkle Litigation Services provides the legal community with peace of mind, transcribing testimony and depositions that can be used reliably by jurors, judges, and attorneys. For all your legal support needs, contact McCorkle Litigation Services online at McCorkleLitigation.com. Tina, excited?
I'm thrilled.
We're now at a fun part of our show. Not that listening to Sestini wasn't fun, of course.
Hey.
But we're at our legal grab bag segment, our second time with our new format. Yeah, we've opened it up a little. We've invited some guests.
Yeah, it was a blast last time. I think we need to keep doing this.
So much fun. So we're really honored to have a couple of important folks with us in studio. Jennifer Coyne is Executive Vice President and General Counsel at Transdev North America. She also spent 20 years at United Airlines, where Jennifer and I worked together, got to know each other.
We did.
So very big thank you to Jennifer for joining us in studio today, Jennifer. And Domati Pongo, journalist, media personality, writer, WGN personality. Very, very privileged to have you in studio as well. Welcome.
It's great to be on with you guys.
All right, this is exciting. So our first story on Grab Bag involves another cake lawsuit. Tina, what's going on?
Well, I'm sure that our listeners remember that back in June, the Supreme Court issued a verdict in one of the most talked about cases in a very long time. The case involved Masterpiece Cake Shop and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And the court had ruled in favor of Jack Phillips, who is the bakery owner who refused to make the wedding cake for a same-sex couple. In a 7-2 decision, the court found that the commission's consideration of the case was inconsistent with the state's obligation of religious neutrality, and that the baker, Jack Phillips, was legitimately refusing to bake the cake based on his religious beliefs and convictions. So now Phillips and his bakery are being accused by the commission of discrimination again after he refused to create a blue and pink cake for a transgender woman's birthday. Phillips filed suit this past Tuesday against officials in the commission and other state officials, claiming that the commission is again overreaching and is on a, quote, crusade to crush him. The complaint claims that, again, because of his devout faith and religion, that he cannot create cakes that express messages or celebrate events that conflict with his religious beliefs, and claims violations of his rights to free speech, right to exercise religion, due process, and equal protection. So
I don't love this case. I don't love this continued, you know, battle over whether people, same-sex people, can get the same, you know, cakes as same-sex people. I think the Supreme Court got it wrong, frankly. What are your thoughts on these cases?
Well, I'm just wondering if this is the only cake shop in Colorado. I mean, what?
Right. Yeah, well, that's a good point.
I mean, and I wonder, and does this happen in cases like this where people will continue to patronize something just so that they can bring up these legal battles so that they can move forth a civil rights cause or move forward with the cause? Because that kind of, if you know how popular this case have been, why is this the spot that you go?
Right. And to your point, I mean, I think a lot of the cases you see go this far, it's by no accident. I mean, they're purposely looking for cases and, you know, bake shops in this case that will lead to those kind of disputes. Jennifer, any thoughts on these cases?
I'm in the same state of mind on this one, because there's something about freedom of religion that does bother me here. If you don't agree with this guy's religious, you know, views, don't go to his cake shop. Go somewhere else, and ultimately, will he go out of business or not? And to force somebody, if it's a truly held belief, which I think with this guy it is, mm-hmm. to force him to bake for something that violates his religious beliefs does have a, I don't know, it's no pun intended, distasteful to me. I like the free market approach better. For example, with Jimmy John's, after we saw those pictures about the wildlife hunting that he had done, I'm pretty sure a lot of people aren't going to Jimmy John's anymore. Right. And I like those free market kinds of, you know,
boycotts and solutions
exactly,
to these problems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Versus this regulated, kind of heavy-handed, telling people what they can and can't do when it's on such an important topic for a lot of people. Yeah.
Do you think that baking a cake is protected under the First Amendment? Do you think that's what the First Amendment is intended to protect? In other words, is that an expression, you know, is creating a cake an expression, just same right, as, you know, giving an opinion or writing something?
It's true. We're in interesting times, because that free speech, that First Amendment, has been spread to cover so many different things. Like, we even see it with the Hobby Lobby case, where you know, or the labor rights cases, where we've seen freedom of speech expand to so many different things. And it just goes to how you view the Constitution and how you view the First Amendment in the first place.
Well, it's viewed as an artistic expression by some. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. And this
that's
is
where
his craft. He's an artist. Yeah.
All right. Moving on to another story that is very timely, given where we are. A lawsuit has been served by the Twitter that all the kids are talking about, Tina.
Yeah, the Twitter. So last Friday, the Democratic National Committee served a lawsuit against WikiLeaks via Twitter, accusing the website of participating in a conspiracy to hack into DNC emails, which we all know significantly impacted the election. The lawsuit claims that WikiLeaks published the stolen data obtained when the Russians hacked into the DNC computers, and that the Trump campaign subsequently used that information and worked in tandem with WikiLeaks to publish the information at times that were beneficial to the Trump campaign. Earlier in the week, the district judge had granted the DNC's motion to serve WikiLeaks via Twitter and mail. Service via Twitter was done through an account that was specifically created for the purpose of serving the lawsuit. And the judge granted the motion for service via Twitter on the basis that the DNC had not been able to serve the lawsuit by any other method. Emails regarding the suit had been returned as undeliverable, and lawyers who had been representing WikiLeaks responded that they no longer represented WikiLeaks and were not authorized to accept service. And of course, WikiLeaks has tweeted on a number of occasions about the lawsuit and is actually seeking donations from anybody who is willing to contribute to their countersuit.
What will they think of next? Service by Wiki? Service by Twitter? Jennifer, ever been served by the Twitter?
I have not been served by the Twitter, the Gram, any of it. But I do like this, I've got to say, and I feel like this will be the first of many where you can't just pick and choose kind of how you want to exist. And when it's fortuitous, you're all over it. When you don't want to be, you know, around, you disappear and claim you can't be. It strikes me as, again, first of many ways we're going to be able to get into this kind of cloud-based ethereal existence of a lot of these entities that don't have physical presence anywhere.
Yeah, and here in Cook County, the big news story lately in the circuit court has been, you know, e-filing is now mandated, and It's taken a while for Cook County to catch up with this technology. Lots of folks are complaining, though, because they're not getting the same access to the court system as they did in the past. What are your thoughts on, you know, technology as it relates to, you know, litigation and folks getting involved in lawsuits?
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right. I mean, we're getting into a space where I like what you said. What's that phrasing you use? Ethereal, cloud-based.
Yeah, ethereal, right? Like, just like out there.
Yeah, yeah. And it makes me, but it also concerns me because when you have these many legal things happening in the public space, in the social media space, it makes you very wary of every single thing that you put out there because you don't know what can be used in these different cases. Will that stretch to private communications via DM if you're talking about things being served via Twitter? Does that cover this type of thing?
Right.
And you know, I don't
well,
know.
It's funny. I mean, it also speaks to, you know, I will frequently text my clients. You know, I mean, we're evolved to the point where I'll text my clients frequently.
Exactly.
But I'm concerned about, you know, the privacy, keeping a record of it, because, you know, that's all important as lawyers. How do we, I mean,
is anything sacred?
Exactly. I mean, it's a different world than when we all started, Tina.
Yes, it's a very different world. When you and I were, you know, the fastest way we could get things to people were either by, you know, Federal Express or by, and then we had telecopy. Ooh.
Back when they called it Federal Express also.
And telecopy.
All right. Telecopy back in
my day. Get off my lawn, crazy kids. Next story is a sad one, but I think we, you know, very important to the legal community here in Chicago. There's a tragedy involving a very prominent Chicago lawyer, actually, you know, world-renowned Supreme Court expert that was very tragically killed this week. Tina, bring us up to speed.
Yes. So the Chicago legal community and folks across the country are in a state of shock and sadness at the news of the murder of Stephen Shapiro, who started the Supreme Court practice at Mayor Brown. Shapiro was shot and killed in his home in Northfield on Monday evening. And when the news broke, the police were characterizing it as a domestic dispute. And within a few hours of the murder, police arrested John Gately III after a standoff with him at his home in Winnetka. We have since learned, actually pretty recently, that Gately is Shapiro's brother-in-law. Police have not yet revealed a motive for the shooting, and Gately was actually scheduled to appear for a bond hearing this afternoon at the Skokie Courthouse. Shapiro joined Mayor Brown in 1972 and made partner in 1978 and then left for a few years to go work in the Solicitor General's office. He ended up subsequently founding the firm's Supreme Court and appellate practice and argued 30 cases before the Supreme Court during his 46-year career. We here at LFO really are very saddened and extend our condolences to his family and his friends and his colleagues.
Yeah, no question. Jennifer, we initially didn't know who the assailant was. Now we've learned that it was a member of the family. You're involved in some issues with domestic you know, violence. What are your thoughts on this case?
That's right, Rich. So I'm on the board of the Chicago Metropolitan Battered Women's Network, and I'd like to echo my condolences to the family because one of the principles I try to live by is write your obituary, not your resume. And when you read about this man, not only professionally but personally, he was somebody who was constantly giving back, but obviously had done very well professionally and I'm assuming financially, but even so was not insulated from the dynamics that underlie a lot of domestic violence. It can be not just what we might only think about of immediate like husband and wife situations, boyfriend, girlfriend. Domestic violence transcends gender. It transcends the economic barriers that sometimes protect people. It is pervasive everywhere, and it's also very closely held. People are still very embarrassed to talk about it. So I'm hopeful that we learn more about this and can use it to shine the spotlight on the violence that is in people's homes often, and it's supposed to be your safest place, and quite often it's not. So this is really a sad thing.
No, it really is. And thinking about what you're saying, Jen, not only thinking about domestic violence and shedding light on that, but violence and gun violence in this city, period. We think about teens on the south and west sides of Chicago, but we don't think about someone as prominent as a Stephen Shapiro being killed in his home. And, you know, it's just a tragic thing.
Yeah, condolences, obviously, to the family. Moving on to the next story, in the world of athletics, this week, a rising college basketball coaching star at Wake Forest University, assistant coach Jamil Jones was arrested for throwing a punch that killed a New York City tourist. The tourist had apparently mistaken Jones for an Uber driver, was inebriated, was knocking on the window of what he thought was the Uber vehicle. It wasn't. Allegedly, Jones stepped out and punched him around 1:15 a.m. On a sidewalk in Queens. He fell, smashed his head, and died. He was visiting from Florida. Now, Jamil Jones has been arrested. He has pled not guilty, said it was a tragic accident, and that they send their deepest condolences. The assistant coach is an assistant to Danny Manning, who most of us remember from a college basketball star back in the day. What are your thoughts on this case? I mean, is it a case of just mistaken identity gone wrong? We've seen other cases in Chicago of people dying after one punch as well.
And we talked about this on with Mark Carmen on WGN Nightside one night about how tragic this case is and how we talk about being careful when it comes to road rage. Someone who had a lot going for him. Jones is another person that was well-liked in his community. And just to have this thing happen.
He's probably going to be a head coach pretty soon at a major program.
He was on his way. Yeah. He was on his way to a major program. But I wonder how do you plead not guilty or call this an accident when you accidentally killed him, but you didn't accidentally assault him. If a fight ensued, according to at least the facts that we see in this case, and later on surveillance footage came out, at least showing him walking away from the scene, what can his defense
be?
Well,
it's really interesting that you raise that, because we've covered, and in the news right now, is the Stand Your Ground trials. Mm-hmm. There's a case going on right now where initially they thought he would be protected by Stand Your Ground. Now they're prosecuting him. The question in this case would be whether Jones thought that he was in danger of bodily harm, exactly. And he was acting in self-defense. Now, who knows the facts surrounding it? I mean, he was banging on his window. That doesn't seem to me like very threatening, So I think on its face, it would seem like a tough defense to show that he was a risk of danger. On the other hand, to your point, there's lots of road rage. You've got some guy banging on your window. You're not an Uber driver. You think he might be attacking you. And it wasn't like he pulled out.
Right, yeah, he was very intoxicated.
He didn't pull out a gun or anything. He punched him. So, yeah, that's going to be some important facts to look at on the case. Tina, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that this is a tragic thing. I don't think that that he had the culpable mens rea, so to speak, to actually kill this person. I think that he was probably concerned about this guy banging on his window, and the fact that he was inebriated didn't help. And I just think it was one of those things. It sounds like he fell in a way that, I think whenever you punch somebody, you sort of have to understand that you can't really predict how this person's going to fall. It sounds, though, like he probably, because of his condition, fell really hard and fell in a way that led to his imminent death.
And I'm sure that's what his attorneys would probably argue. The one thing that may help him out in this case, though, is he didn't continue to assault him once he fell. That might be the one piece that kind of helps him out. Because looking at some news stories that we talked about previously, when the person continues that assault after the person has already fallen, then it becomes very hard to use that self-defense type of defense.
No question. All right, moving on. Who's got a dog on the panel? Anyone dog owner? Dog lover?
I do.
Here?
I do have a dog.
I am not a doggy daddy, no.
I have cats because Sussler is allergic to dogs.
Well, this is a story involving a lawsuit against Rachel Ray, who has a natural dog food brand called Nutrish. A man in New York is suing her for allegedly producing this product that contains a harmful herbicide. He has filed on behalf of a class, a $5 million lawsuit, arguing that she and the company are deceiving because she is marketing the dog food as natural. The lawsuit says these claims are false, deceptive, and misleading. The products at issue are not natural. In a statement to media, Smucker, which owns Nutrish, has said that they stand strongly behind the quality of their products, and that they plan to aggressively fight these claims. So, Jennifer, do you look at when you buy food for your dog? What kind of dog do you have?
So, I have a English Lab, and 2 days ago I was in Costco reading the Kirkland Costco brand
because
ingredients.
Of this?
Not because of this, but because
you're
there's,
a, responsible dog
there's a lot of concern about what is in pet food and where it's manufactured. So there's a ton of labeling on dog food. And it's interesting because I got my dog from another lawyer who breeds him for fun. And he's like, just give her Purina. You know, it's no big deal. Yeah. But people are
Alpo.
Very... Right.
Do they still make Alpo, by the way? Is that still a thing?
They do.
Remember
they
Alpo?
Do.
Oh, I remember Alpo.
Lauren Green, those commercials?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
The little thing.
But this is a big thing for that's people and their dogs and the
people will pay more for their dogs than they will for themselves. Right?
For their own food, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, but shouldn't you be able to rely on a label that says natural, or should you be more of a thoughtful consumer? What
absolutely not. I mean, I tell the guys with the men buns, just because it says it's organic doesn't mean
that's right.
You know, they say that a lot. Orion Samuelson has a commercial that runs on WGN Radio where he talks about this craze over non-GMO products. And he says they even have it on orange juice. He said orange juice never had GMO in it. It just becomes a marketing ploy. So I think it raises our attention not only to dog food, but how often are we really paying attention to what's in our food and if those labels are really even applicable to what it is that we're buying.
Yeah, Tina, we talked earlier about brand protection, how important it is to protect your brand. Obviously, Rachel Ray, huge personality, well-known. Smucker Company, the parent company, even bigger. How important is it for them to fight this case aggressively to protect this brand called Nutrish?
I think it's critically important because the claims are going to the essence of why people purchase products. A lot of what a brand is about creating trust among your consumers. And this is one of those things where if the trust isn't there, it will greatly impact sales. So I think it's critically important.
Last story is involving Jennifer Coyne's favorite movie of all time, The Mighty Ducks. Sean Weiss was arrested a few days ago in Northern California after police found him high on drugs and acting bizarrely. What really struck Tina and I about the story was not really the arrest, because, many former child actors get arrested.
And we talk about all of them on Legal Face-Off.
We do. But the mugshot, man, come on. I'm thinking of a new segment called Guess That Mugshot, because this mugshot, which we're all looking at, and you could, look up, obviously, yourself, man, how Sean Weiss has fallen. Forget even the picture he was as a Mighty Duck, which is dramatically different, but even...
He's 38 years old.
He looks 60. Reverse those numbers. That's a hard 38. Yeah?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, not
this
a good
is
look.
Unfortunate to see.
It caused me to pull up some other celebrity mugshots, and we're going to play our favorite game on LFO. Guess who is in the mugshot. You ready, Tina?
Yes,
I'm
ready.
Well, this one I think is fairly easy because it's...
Oh, that's
that?
Heather Locklear.
It also says Heather Locklear, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
But not a great picture of Heather. Not as good as the...
But did you see that she still tried to smile? She's got
a little wry.
She tried.
All right, do we recognize this celebrity right here?
I do not.
All right, Jennifer?
Oh, that's, I don't.
That's a private brand, Jessica Alba.
Private brand? That's close. That's not bad. It's Naya Rivera from Glee. She's, looking...
Glee is the curse.
Wow.
Glee
alone. It's a rough ride.
All right, how about this... Gentlemen, this is a tough one right here. I'm going to put this up in front of us. Of course, we're showing pictures on a radio podcast, which isn't the most thoughtful thing to do. But what do you think, Tina? Jennifer?
Oh, I don't know, but that guy's had a hard life.
A young Iggy Pop? I'm not sure.
Justin Bieber in 20 years?
This would be Aaron Carter. Aaron Carter's DUI shot right here.
He's a David Bowie wannabe.
That's right. Here's my personal favorite right here.
Oh, that's De Niro.
It looks like De Niro. Anyone else?
Oh, I know that face.
It looks like De Niro.
Hey Now. I'll give you a hint. Hey Now, any Larry Sanders fans with me? Rip Torn.
Whoa.
Oh, wow.
Maybe use a comb for this mugshot. A couple more here.
He looks like De Niro.
Can you name this one? This future titan of industry.
Oh, that looks like Bill Gates.
That's got to be Bill Gates.
Bill Gates.
Why was he arrested?
It was something involving...
hacking?
A traffic violation. Apparently in 1977, they threw you in jail for traffic violations.
His glasses. He's still wearing those same glasses.
Yeah. He looked better back then, though. Yeah. It's kind of stylish.
Finally, who's this person? Very devilish looking in this picture. Anyone know? Tina?
Is that Mickey Rourke?
No, close.
Is that a young Hannibal Lecter?
Close also.
Mass Shooter comes to mind.
Andy Dick, famous comedian. Frequently arrested. It was hard to pick the right mugshot for him.
Well, it's because his hair color is not the right color.
That's right. What's the takeaway here? When we're taking a mugshot, should we apply makeup? Get a better stylist.
That is a good call. So what do you do when you take them? Do you smile as if it's like a driver's license?
You look demonic when you smile in a mugshot.
Well, Nick Nolte had the best.
That's true.
The Nick Nolte one with like the crazy hair and Hawaiian shirt. And well, it's our favorite game here on Legal Face-Off. Guess the mugshot. Thank you so much to our guests for joining us.
It was great. Thanks for
this
having
really
us.
Yeah.
Come back anytime. We appreciate it. Tina Martini.
Rich Lankoff.
Thank you. Thank you for a great show. And thank you, of course, behind the glass, our friend Ben, Sam Panianowicz, wherever you are.
Drinking a pina colada in Las Vegas.
And we'll see you next time on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lankoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Cover.